Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 8th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. In a series of recent statements, Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized how we are edging ever closer to a World War III thermonuclear confrontation between the United States and Russia. And I want to highlight certain events in the last days that are hastening this trend. For example, the wide circulation of the story that Syria is arming chemical weapons and preparing them for use against rebel forces. And this was followed by a strong warning from Obama that this would be a red line. And now we have Tony Blair in the United States saying that Assad's days are numbered, that Assad is preparing this chemical weapons attack on his population, and Blair is calling for arming the so-called rebels. There was also a vote in the U.S. Senate, a 92-6 vote, which gives credibility to the idea that the Libya scenario should be played out for Syria, which includes a no-fly zone. It's the actual resolution called for a study of a no-fly zone, but that's these kinds of studies tend to be self-fulfilling. Also this week, we had the agreement from the NATO foreign ministers to deploy Patriot 3 missiles to the Turkish border with Syria. And there are also reports being circulated that the Assad regime is collapsing. Assad is depressed. His supporters are depressed. Reports from the ground seem to contradict this, but don't let reality get in the way of a story that's designed to create a war. Now, the U.S.-Syria policy is one that Lyndon LaRouche identified right after the murder of Gaddafi in Libya. And he warned that this is not about Libya or Syria, but about a U.S. Operation run by the British from the top to go after the Russians and the Chinese. And what we see is the playing out of this. This has been going on for a year now, the U.S. backing for an Anglo-Saudi operation, which would provoke a broader set of imperial wars. We're already in a World War III in the Middle East generally, and it's spreading throughout Africa. So the question that we want to take up today is, how do we stop this? What do we do? Not just LaRouche Pack, but you, the listeners. What can you do to make sure that this is derailed? Now, one of the keys to doing this, is to identify how the U.S., under President Obama, has been behaving as an arm of this British imperial policy. Of course, as we mentioned before, Tony Blair has been a key architect in the buildup toward this war, beginning with his role in Iraq, backing Bush to the hilt, in fact, pushing Bush to go to war against Saddam Hussein, the Blair role in Libya, and now again for Syria. And this goes back to his 1999 speech that we're at the end of the era of Westphalia, no more national sovereignty. Now, on the program today, we're going to review this British monarchy's imperial direction of this war drive. And we'll be looking at one of the key enforcers of this policy, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice. Rice is rumored to be Obama's choice to replace Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. And she's recently been in the news over her lies on the incident in Benghazi in which four Americans were killed. And what we're going to look at today is how this is a continuation of her role over the last two decades as a cold-blooded killer. This story was brought to light this week in an article titled "Defeat Susan Rice for Her Genocide in Africa," which appeared in the December 7th issue of Executive Intelligence Review. And today on the LaRouche Show, we will speak with the author of that article, Lawrence Freeman, who's been engaged as a representative on Africa policy with Mr. LaRouche for the last couple of decades. He's visited Africa several times, has been invited by groups, among them governments and non-governmental organizations, to come to Africa. He's also very prominent in Washington, D.C., both for his opposition to these British genocidal policies, but also in leading the fight for real development of the continent. So, Larry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Holly.
I'd like to begin with this question of Susan Rice, and we've discussed quite a bit in depth on the LaRue show in the last weeks her lies on Benghazi and how this is part of a broader cover-up. But before we go into her background to show the continuity of this with her history, do you have anything new that's coming up on Benghazi? Are there hearings, new revelations, anything new?
Well, I think that the only thing that's becoming clear to a lot of people is that they have not been told the truth about Benghazi. And the question is, they keep asking why, but no one has answered that really honestly and accurately except for Mr. LaRouche, EIR magazine, and our organization in identifying the fact that Obama is functioning as a British puppet in making his policy towards North Africa, the Middle East, and the Gulf countries. And that's the only way to understand Obama, and that's really the only way to understand why he has Susan Rice as his ambassador to the United Nations, and why he has thinking about appointing Susan Rice or nominating Susan Rice to be Secretary of State, is that they're both connected to the British.
That's very clear from your article, and so we might as well go into some of the aspects of that, because the obvious point here is that why is it that Obama would want to appoint someone who recently seemed to discredit herself with her lies? So what you point out is that she's been involved in this policy, this British policy in Africa, for years. So why don't you give us some of the background, both in terms of the genocide in the Congo and also the situation with Sudan?
Well, if we start with the situation in Sudan, I think that's interesting because we can make a direct connection to why she did what she did on Benghazi. Because when she came into office in 1993, and she was her whole education after she graduated from Stanford, United States. I mean, she went to, she was a Rhodes Scholar, went to Oxford, and received numerous awards for her thesis, which was promoting the role of the British Empire in Zimbabwe. And then she came back to the United States and went to Canada for a while. But when she joined the government in 1993, she had already formed a political ideology to destroy the nation of Sudan. And that was her policy from 1993 on to the present day. And she worked with a cabal of people who agreed with regime change and overthrowing the government of Sudan, and they're still working at it today. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, and which come to light, is the fact that from 1996 all the way up to 2000, there were repeated attempts by the government of Sudan to, A, hand over Osama bin Laden, and if not accepting him, they were willing to hand over the files and all the intelligence they had gathered on his organization. There were repeated attempts, and the U.S. government, and this is still being an issue that's brought up today, because of Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State, and by 1997, Susan Rice was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, they both rejected any offers made by the Sudanese government in Khartoum and also Sudanese intelligence representatives who came to Washington, D.C.
So they made these offers from the Sudanese government, top
yes.
officials, to the Clinton administration.
Yes. And there was the people who rejected it, the FBI was open, the CIA was open, but it kept being rejected by people in the State Department. And what people said very clearly was that Rice had politicized Sudan because of her own political views. She refused to take any action to actually work with the government, including the fact that the embassy in Sudan was shut down in 1996. It was a bogus charge. Even the ambassador at the time said there was no reason for it. And when there were attempts to reopen the embassy, again, Rice said no. And diplomats said it. Then and now, this was a major mistake. You have to have an embassy open if you're actually going to work with the people and carry on intelligence work.
Well, now, you've been to Sudan a couple of times. What is the animus? What is it that Rice and others have against the government of Sudan?
Well, it basically goes back to the whole Anglo-American policy towards nation states in Africa and the Middle East. The current government came into power in 1989, led by General Bashir, who became the president. And he's been there. And by the way, it was a bloodless coup. It was no military killings or anything. And this represented an Islamic grouping at the time, which has somewhat changed over the years into becoming a more nationalist grouping. And people like Tony Lake, Susan Rice at the top, and a whole bunch of other scoundrels didn't want to have this government there and didn't want to have a central national government in Sudan. Sudan, if you look at a map, before it was broken up last year, was the largest country in Africa. It also dominates the Horn of Africa. It's also the home of the Nile River, which is a huge, huge river system for East Africa. So it's always been a strategic target of the British going back to the 1800s. And therefore, they have never wanted to have or allow a nation state to develop in Sudan. Don't forget, it has the largest concentration of arable land, arguably anywhere in the world, in terms of land that everyone has analyzed could produce a food for a billion people if it was developed, and it remains completely undeveloped to this day, even though this has been known for about 40 years of this potential.
But they've been trying to build some dams. I think you visited one of their dams.
They built some dams. They built some very some small dams. They built the Murawi Dam, which I visited in 2009, producing 1,250 megawatts. But the country is so largely underdeveloped, and now it's split off. And South Sudan has this arable land, about 58 million acres. And they're completely, even more underdeveloped than what we call now North Sudan or just Sudan. So they've done some work, but it's so little compared to this huge, huge, vast territory. It's really criminal that the West never did anything. And that's the point, that while these people, Rice and others, were in government, they were more intent on overthrowing the regime of Khartoum to destabilize and break up the country, which it has already now, than they obviously were of developing the country.
And wasn't there a line for a period of time that one of the reasons we couldn't trust Sudan is that they were harboring bin Laden?
Well, Clinton, who had, in my view, had a very bad policy in Africa, mm-hmm. Yeah, early on in his first administration, he put Sudan on the list of state sponsoring terrorism. And so this became a big issue. And then there was a rumor circulated which came from South Sudan at the time, that there was going to be an assassination of a leading government official, which was being run by Sudan. So early on, they were labeled, and bin Laden had moved there and was running operations there. And so in 1996, the government of Sudan, the official intelligence division, made these series of offers. Some, almost all of them private, some through back channel, some through the government itself. That is, you had U.S. ambassadors, two U.S. ambassadors, at least that I know of, meeting with officials of Sudan government to coordinate some change in monitoring bin Laden, offering their help to the United States. And this was repeatedly rejected. And I find this very interesting, because if you look at what Rice was called upon to do for President Obama, she was the individual chosen in the entire government of Obama because of her closeness to him. She was chosen to go on TV and openly lie about what we knew about the attack that led to the assassination of our U.S. ambassador. And because it was a political deployment by Obama, and therefore she was willing to do a political deployment regardless of the truth or the interest of the United States, and it's exactly the same political deployment that she was doing in the Clinton administration. So she has no regard for the truth, she has no regard for the interest of the United States, and she has no regard for the interest of Africa. She's a political animal, and she's carrying out the Tony Blair regime change policy, as is Obama.
And it should be noted in this chronology that Sudan was making this offer vis-a-vis bin Laden before the original 9/11.
Well, actually, go back a little bit before that. He finally leaves the country. The Sudan kicks him out, and he takes his whole family and him, about 150 people, and they go, guess where? To Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So this is a very brilliant political move on our part. But in 1998, you had two embassies, which led to the death of a couple hundred people, the U.S. embassy in Kenya and in Tanzania. Both embassies were struck with a very bloody incident, and it was done allegedly, according to intelligence reports, by bin Laden. So you can make the case, and this is a case that is made by other people in addition to us, that if we had acted on the Sudan offers to arrest or examine or monitor bin Laden with the government of Sudan itself, you could have prevented these two bombings in 98, and of course possibly prevented the 2001 bombing that killed over 3,000 Americans. So it's not unfair to lay this at the doorstep of this judgment, political ideology of Susan Rice, and it's, as I said earlier, it's the same political ideology that's driving her today to lie about what happened in Libya.
You're listening to Larry Freeman, the author of an article. I would encourage you to go on the LaRouchePub.com website, the EIR site, and read it. It's called Defeat Susan Rice for Her Genocide in Africa. It's in the December 7th issue. Don't just read it. Print it out. Circulate it. Send it out. This is the kind of information that has to get into the hands of the American people if we are to get our sovereignty back. Now, she was in the Clinton administration then till the end, I take it.
Yes, she was in there for almost a full 8 years of his two administrations.
Now, one of the things that I found interesting is that she went from there to the Brookings Institute, and as a senior fellow, was one of the loudest voices among nominally Democratic Party foreign policy officials defending the Bush-Cheney-Blair policy to go into Iraq. She gave a speech where she said, it's clear that Iraq poses a major threat. It's clear that its weapons of mass destruction need to be dealt with forcefully. Mm. And then she said that we need to be prepared to move forward as we must on the military side. And then after Colin Powell's speech at the UN, she put out a statement very strongly supporting it. So how did she get into the Obama administration? What's the relationship between her and Obama? Because supposedly Obama was against the Iraq war.
Well, I don't know how the particulars work. What we see from what we've discussed so far is there was an affinity between candidate Obama and Susan Rice because they both had an agreement on this aspect of carrying out British policy. Whether they saw it that way or not, it was the regime change policy that they both agreed with and had this outlook towards the rest of the world. She was, even though she was almost 8 years in the Clinton administrations, she was broke early from the Clintons in the sense that she refused to, not just she refused to support Hillary Clinton in her run for president against Obama in 2008, but she did it early, and she became one of the top advisors to Obama, and they used her throughout the campaign to attack Hillary for Hillary's inexperience in foreign policy. So she was one of the attack dogs of Obama against Hillary Clinton, even though she'd been part of the administration. And there was a big fight over who's going to be Secretary of State because everybody knew that Susan Rice wanted to be Secretary of State. For whatever reasons, Obama, in one of his better decisions, chose Hillary Clinton, probably because at that point Hillary was the most popular political figure in the United States, even though he had won the presidency. So he chose her, and he gave Rice the position of UN envoy, but then he made it a cabinet position.
Right.
So she's right involved in the cabinet continually.
Well, I think we should go back a few years because we don't want to forget her role in the situation with the Congo. And I think, to me, this is the thing that, that ought to be. The Sudan situation is clear as you just presented it. But the situation with the Congo is even more grotesque in a relationship with Kagame and with Uganda. So I'd like you to give us a sense of her role in defending the genocide that's taken somewhere around 6 million lives in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
You're right that the Congo story is actually much better known than the Sudan story, and there is a lot of outrage about it from elected officials and also Africans, because it is really disgusting. And on this ground alone, she should be removed from the her position as envoy, ambassador to the United Nations, and not even considered for a nomination just on the fact of what she's done to the Congo, because in her first position inside the Clinton administration, she was had a lower-level position in the National Security Council, and then she was bumped up to senior advisor to the president, I think, around 96, before she became Secretary of State for Africa in 97. And when the genocide, as it's called, against the Tutsis took place in 1994 in the spring, she is quoted infamously for saying, look, if we call this genocide, then we're going to have to take action. And that will hurt our chances, i.e. the Clinton administration, Democrat Party, 94, in the midterm general election scheduled for November 94. So that quote is well known, and it's very callous, and obviously it's disgusting. What happened then is that the United States backed a series of invasions by Uganda, whose president is Museveni, and Rwanda, whose president is Kagame, backed a series of invasions into the Congo beginning in 1996. And what happened after 94 is when Kagame, who is not yet the president of Rwanda, who actually came was working with Museveni in Uganda, he went into Rwanda and he chased out the so-called Hutu genocidals, as they were called. And these Hutus went over and camped out in the Congo. I mean, there were millions of them in disgusting refugee camps. And the U.S. gave the green light for Kagame and Museveni to send their people into the Congo and disperse these people because they, quote, were going after a handful of alleged genocidalists who carried out the genocide of 94. So in 96, you had a new invasion into the Congo and it eventually led to the overthrow of the president at that time, Mobutu. But in the process, millions of people were killed. Then the president they put in place, Laurent Kabila, had a falling out with Kagame and Museveni. And so there was now
Kagame
a second
and Museveni
war.
Put Kabila in place initially.
Correct. And they threw out the president Mobutu, right. And they installed this guy, Laurent Kabila, who had no credentials to be president. This was all done with okays from the United States. And, of course, the U.S. State Department, where Susan Rice was, and the National Security Council.
And
so
just so our listeners know, there are tremendous natural resources in that area, which is
correct.
Not incidental to this story at all.
No, because in this eastern part of the Congo, if people look on a map, you see Rwanda borders the Congo in this area and sort of the portion of Uganda on what's called the Kivu, K-I-V-U, where you have just enormous amount of wealth and precious material, coltan, other material used for all kinds of production of advanced technological equipment in this area. And so what really happened is that Rwanda and Uganda, they set up their own armies or rebel armies that they supported for control of these resources. And in 98, when there was a falling out because Kabila didn't want to give them any more control of these resources, then Rwanda and Uganda went in and basically had a destabilization with the country. Kabila remained in power because five other African countries defended him. But at that point, from that point on, there's been a continuous war and looting of the eastern Congo, which probably at least maybe more than 6 million people died. Up to the present day, not because they died from combatant wounds, but they died from lack of food, health care, dirty water, which was a consequence of this war sponsored, or at least allowed to occur by the West. So this is well documented by a series of UN reports. The most recent case, again, is you have Kagame of Rwanda is reported by UN reports to be supporting another rebel group, M23, it's called, and they have been trying to carve up the Congo and continuing maintain control of this area in Kivu for mineral resources. And everybody has pointed to the fact that Susan Rice was covering for the same president, Kagame, in the 94-96 period. In fact, in 96 or 97, when we were preparing for the next invasion into the Congo, Susan Rice said, let Kagame and Museveni deal with these people. They know how to take care of things, referring to getting rid of the Hutus. So you have a disgusting genocidalist who's still carrying out the exact same policy today.
The rest of that quote that you had in your article goes back to what you said about turning away from genocide in the 94 period. The rest of that quote is they know how to deal with that. The only thing we have to do is look the other way.
Exactly. And now, we look the other way, and 6 million people are dead, Congolese people. So people get all worked up in the United States over the genocide against the Jews, which was a horrible crime. But this is bigger. And we have a African-American who is the leader of it sitting in the United Nations, who some people want to support in becoming Secretary of State. And what happened recently is the United Nations did another report on Rwanda's support for the M23 rebels. Susan Rice tried to keep the report from being published. They finally published it just in November. They finally republished it, which said explicitly Kagame's role in this, the president of Rwanda. And now the UN resolution of UN Security Council wanted to issue a resolution condemning Kagame for his support. So this would not just this would be a resolution from the UN Security Council, and Susan Rice has blocked that. So the UN Security Council resolution came out and said, we call on those supporting the M23 to stop, but they would not put in the name of Kagame, the president of Rwanda, because of Susan Rice. She blocked it. So this person has been carrying out, at least since 1994, you could say 96, almost two decades, a decade and a half, of genocide in the Congo. Why would you want to have someone like that represent you as Secretary of State?
And Larry, that brings us to one of the eye-popping ironies of the situation, because she's one of the leading promoters of this idea of the responsibility to protect, that we, powerful Western nations, have the responsibility to intervene on behalf of victims of human rights violations. And yet you look at her own role, and you see what a fraud that is. Now, I'd like to then take this up from the question of what she's doing today, because, again, you see this the U.S. explicitly being brought in by Obama, by Susan Rice, by Samantha Power, as an enforcement arm of this British imperial policy from Libya and Syria. What has been Rice's role with this responsibility to protect? What can you tell us about that?
Well, the reports that we got, which I think were accurate, is in the build-up to Obama's military bombing campaign in Libya, which goes back to March of last year. They point to Rice and Samantha Powers and others to be the, quote, iron women who were the backbone to Obama and much tougher than these impotent white men, as they called it. So that convinced Obama to carry out the campaign of regime change and eventually assassination of President Gaddafi. And so she was a leading voice in this policy. And this policy was the beginning for the world to see, and also I think that this was an eye-opener for the Russians and Chinese, that the United States was going to carry out regime change if they were militarily not stopped. And therefore, after Libya, I think that's when the Russians began to realize that they were now how to protect their own country, their own sovereignty, from a future attempts at destabilization by the West. And in this policy in Libya, the excuse was similar to what we saw with the Iraq War and similar to what we're seeing today in Syria. You start a lie, and the Iraq War was Saddam Hussein could deliver a mushroom cloud in 45 minutes to Europe. And so Tony Blair convinced Condoleezza Rice and President Bush and Cheney to go with that. There was never a shred of evidence. There was never any weapons of mass destruction. In Libya, there was going to be a massacre in Benghazi if we didn't start bombing Libyan troops that day. And that, of course, that was never proven either. And now today in Syria, with no evidence presented so far, not a shred of evidence presented so far, we're supposed to be preparing for another regime change policy because of allegedly the president of Syria, Assad, is preparing to use chemical weapons, with, again, no evidence presented. And this, at every point, you see Susan Rice is championing the regime change policy, which is a British policy, comes directly, as you pointed out earlier, from Tony Blair. So the fact that Obama carries out this British policy and Rice carries out this British policy of overthrowing governments, you really have two British puppets working together, and that's what makes it completely understandable of why he would nominate, if he does, a genocidalist to be Secretary of State. It can be understood by both of their relationships to following British policy.
Well, there's another side to it as well, which emerged in Libya and is really part of the whole Benghazi story, and we see it again in Syria, which is that our intervention has had a beneficiary, which is not the Democratic Forces for Change, but Al-Qaeda. And that the administration, Obama ran for president saying he's finished off Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda's on the run. Yeah, they're on the run to Benghazi, they're on the run to Syria to carry out genocide and regime change. So again, we see that Rice and Obama serving this British geopolitical doctrine.
Correct. And the other aspect of it, which is the overthrow of Gaddafi, has directly spread the policy, the conditions for Al-Qaeda and related groups now to expand all across the Sahel and Western Africa. And what happened is that the Tuaregs left Libya. They've been in Libya during the fighting. And when on Gaddafi's behalf, and when Gaddafi was overthrown, they were able to gather up advanced weapons, pickup trucks, which are the modern-day camel of the Sahel, and basically go in and take over northern Mali and set up a new base, of which some people are saying is the strong point of what they call Al-Qaeda of the Maghreb being the northern Africa.
Right.
So this is now the policies towards Libya directly created the policies towards Mali. Now that Mali is a new base, at least northern Mali, a new base for these Al-Qaeda extremists, as they call them. And this is now being targeted. And there's a new UN policy and U.S. policy and NATO policy for considering a military intervention into northern Mali. So every one of these moves that we take under Obama's leadership, which is his British policy, is further destabilizing the world. And sooner or later, and this is the danger that Mr. LaRouche points to, we're going to get closer and closer to a direct confrontation with Russia as we further destabilize and overthrow countries in the Middle East and North Africa. And Rice and Obama are intent on extending this policy to the limit.
I think just one other irony before we move into another area of discussion is that here you have Obama, who touts his great heroism in standing up for women's rights, allied with the Saudi regime, which is one of the most brutal regimes when it comes to women. You can't even drive a car They're talking about implanting chips in Saudi women so they can't leave the country without their husbands. But that, that we could take up at another point. I want to get to something that I think is pretty dear to your heart in terms of your role in trying to change the policy towards Africa. It's not just a question of defeating Rice and Obama. But one of the things Lyndon LaRouche talked about last night in his Friday Project webcast is the Green Program, that the Green Program is genocide. And as you said a little earlier, it's not direct fighting and bullets and bombs that are killing millions of people in Africa. It's underdevelopment. It's the so-called subsistence policies, the anti-development policies. And, of course, you have, on the other side, presented a whole series of proposals, as has LaRouche PAC, and Helga Zepp LaRouche has just brought that forward again in from Europe. So I'd like to take up, first of all, this question of the continuing colonial policy in Africa, this time as the form of a green policy. I think this is actually killing more people than the old colonial policy did, huh?
Oh, sure. I mean, the old colonial policy of British troops mainly, and some French troops in Africa, I mean, there was a limit to how many people they would be able to kill. I mean, even when Kitchener retook Sudan in 1898 and killed 20,000 followers of Islam, that's nothing compared to what you have every day and every year. You have 5 million people a year, mainly children, dying in Africa from disease and diseases that were conquered on every other continent in the world but Africa, such as extreme diarrhea, cholera. Children die of cholera in Africa. So this is not understandable. If you look at it from the objective standpoint, you look at this continent, has major rivers, the Congo and the Nile, there's two, the Niger, has huge rivers, has huge agricultural potential, has huge resources, mineral resources, oil resources, et cetera. So why isn't it developed? It's a no-brainer that if you're interested in developing humanity, you would develop this continent. Yet it remains the most underdeveloped continent on the planet. In fact, the Congo, I did a research paper a couple of years ago, and the Congo is the most deficit-ridden country in terms of infrastructure. It has the least infrastructure per square kilometer of land and per person of any country. So why? You have to understand it, and it can only be understood from an intention. And one of the policies that you see, and you see the emergence of imperialism and environmentalism in Africa very clearly, because the environmentalists say, leave these people, don't develop these areas, don't give them modern technology, don't give them water development. I remember one of the environmentalists said, look, they can put buckets and cans outside their homes when it rains, and that's the way they collect water. They don't really need irrigation. Now, of course, in Africa, you have extremes of seasons where there's no rain, and then, of course, there are rainy seasons. And these murderers don't even want to allow Africans to have that kind of technology. But if you go to the political side, the imperialist side, you see that Africa, the lack of infrastructure development in Africa has been the policy of the West. And this was made clear in a paper by Henry Kissinger, which was later declassified, but he wrote in 74 to 76, right. National Security Study Memorandum 200, where this document lays out explicitly, we need an uninterrupted flow of mineral resources from Africa. Therefore, we have to prevent these countries from growing industrially and growing in population. And it named countries that should not be allowed to grow at the rate that they were in terms of the fertility rates. So you have Kissinger stating this. And from the 1970s on, which is basically about 10 years after the so-called winds of change where colonialism had to leave Africa,
right.
From 1970 on, the United States and Europe do nothing to develop Africa. 50 years now. And therefore, there is that conscious intent to kill people and this is the policy of the Kissinger colonial imperialist faction as well as the Green faction.
And Larry, I think this one of the important dividing lines here was the assassination of President Kennedy, as Lynn has pointed out, that how critical this was in the generational shift, in the deindustrialization of the United States. It's also the case that you had with Eisenhower and the Adams for Peace idea, some of the policies of Kennedy, who was a spokesman for decolonization when he was in the Senate. There clearly was a sense that, Africa could be developed, and then there was debt collection and destruction of nations, and as you said, we've seen no development over this last 50-year period. But let me ask you something. How conscious is it among African leaders, and especially those who have lived through this 40-year, 50-year period, how conscious of it are they that this is a design of destroying nations and killing people?
Well, some of them have a general view that this has been deliberate, but they don't know by who, and they don't know why. They just have an idea that somehow they've not been allowed to develop, they've not been aided, given any support by the West. In a couple of cases, for example, in Sudan, you do see an understanding on some level that the British are the main enemy of the country. They fought the British, as I said, the last battle was in 1898, so it's in their mind, it's in their memory, but they don't ever understand what the guiding policy of the British is against them. You see similar things in Zimbabwe, which actually just became independent in 1980, so the country is not even, it's just a little bit over 30 years old, and they were fighting the British and Rhodesia. So they also have a memory, very current memory, of the British and their policies. But they don't understand how and why the British are motivated to carry out this, to enforce the policy of no development for Africa. And unfortunately, a lot of leaders who did have some better views on this in the 60s were killed, who have been eliminated from office. And so, therefore, there's really a lack of leaders in Africa who are willing to make a fight for the development of Africa on the level that it would have to be. African countries could never initiate an actual reversal of these global monetarist policies, but they could participate in creating a change in Africa if they were more aware and understood better what the British policy is. And they're often caught flat-footed because they don't understand this policy at the highest level, that the British actually do believe there are too many people. The royal family actually does believe that more people are bad, and black people are very bad, and we should not be allowed to have families such as in northern Nigeria, where you have 6, 7, 8 kids to a family. They consider that evil and must be stopped. Too many black people being born in Africa is destroying the planet. They don't understand the evil of this policy. They just see certain ramifications of it. And therefore, they're ill-prepared to respond to it and to count and support policies that would change it. And the only policies that will change it is if we get a global change in policy, and then we have to carry out regional and continental-wide infrastructure projects in energy, water, and rail transportation that go across countries in Africa. We have to put together a list of key projects from the top down and get African leaders to unite and say, these are going to be implemented, and we're going to change the topology of the African continent in the next generation. That commitment is not there, unfortunately.
But I understand that when you've been there in the past and been able to give some presentations, you see, you can bring out the skepticism of the sustainable development or the green genocide. But is it just that there's a disbelief that the West would ever invest in Africa, or is there excitement about some of these projects, like TransAqua, for example?
Well, what you do is you find individuals who are superior in their intellectual outlook, and they do get excited about our proposals. I mean, I've met some people who are really happy about our proposals for TransAqua, which for the listeners is taking a very small portion of the huge river, a water that passes through the Congo River, and taking just 5% of it and sending it north across the Central African Republic to River Chari, which would refurbish Lake Chad, which is going dry. This would affect 50 million people immediately in Niger, Chad, Cameroon, and Nigeria, but it would also begin to transform the desert. These projects, which have been around since the late 70s, do create excitement among certain individuals, and certain policies that our organization, Mr. LaRouche, who has been to Sudan himself, and Ms. LaRouche has been to Sudan, and she, Helga, has also been to Nigeria, there is recognition that these would be policies that would improve the conditions of life for the people. But they've been scared, they've been beaten down, they've been brutalized, they think of themselves as second-class citizens. So it's only very exceptional people who have the courage to stand up and fight for these policies and fight directly against British policies. I have a friend who passed away early this year, and Professor Sam Maluko, and he was one of the very few Nigerians and very few Africans who actually had an intellectual commitment to fight against the British IMF policies. Other people gripe about them, but they learn to live with them or accept them because they don't feel they have the power to change them, which is very unfortunate.
It's a little ironic, but your description just now of the African population could probably be applied, and I think has been applied by Mr. LaRouche, to the U.S. population in its capitulation to the British control of the debate. But let me bring up another question for you, because you get this a lot in organizing. There's a bugaboo that's been created of the Chinese in Africa, that China is going in there, they're going to steal the raw materials. What do you know about the Chinese involvement in Africa now?
Well, I did a book review for EIR, and I titled it "Why the West Fears China in Africa," because this is it's actually humorous in one level, because what the Chinese have done is they have not presented visionary continental programs that are transformative, such as we have with an East-West Railroad, the African Path for bringing water from the Congo all the way up to the Mediterranean, the TransAqua. What they have done is they have built very basic projects in these countries for water management, hydroelectric power mainly, some railroad development, road development, schools, highways. And it's a huge, huge investment by China. And it's a top-down policy. They made a decision in the 80s and 90s. And then in the decade of 2000 to 2010, they carried out a very aggressive policy throughout Africa. I heard estimates that about $40 billion a year in contracts related that the Chinese are involved in, infrastructure contracts, total about $40 billion a year. So then you hear idiots in the West, and some of these right-wingers saying, well, we have to fight China over Africa. We have to confront China over Africa. But the fact of the matter is the Chinese are doing what the Americans and Europeans should have been doing a half century ago. And in fact, the Chinese are actually following aspects of the American system. They're providing state credit from the Chinese government, very long-term, low-interest loans, 2%, 15, 20-year payout period for basic projects of water energy development and other road development in these countries. They're doing what the United States and Europe should have been doing. And the United States, because of Henry Kissinger's policy, have not done it. So now people are complaining about Africa, about the Chinese involvement in Africa, when we were the ones who created the conditions for the Chinese to do this. And this is typical of how the West and how the mindless Americans and Europeans are manipulated. We had a responsibility. You brought up John Kennedy. Kennedy had a very clear idea as U.S. senator. And when he got elected president, he was seen as the hope of Africa. Roosevelt had a very a good policy to use what he had learned in the New Deal to develop Africa. There was a whole program developed, for example, to develop Iran. So instead of destroying Iran, Roosevelt wanted to actually build up Iran, and he was in a direct fight with British imperialism. And they used the word British imperialism in trying to have an American policy to develop Iran. Kennedy was a student of Roosevelt, and he was going to do this for Africa. And he treated the early African leaders, the early president of Nigeria came to the United States and had a wonderful meeting with President Kennedy, and Patrice Lumumba, who was targeted for assassination in 1960 because he was fighting the British and Belgian colonialist policy. He was captured by the colonialist through element in the Congo, and they were trying to kill him. And they eventually did kill him in January, around January 18th. And his last efforts were to get free to reach the ears of President Kennedy, because he thought President Kennedy would free him and return the Congo back under his political control for policies against the colonialists. So that's how Africans saw. In fact, I met in Sudan. There's a whole section of Sudan where they develop agriculture called the Gezerra Scheme. And the Gezerra Scheme was a direct continuation of people in Sudan who were looking at what Roosevelt said in the Atlantic Charter in 1943, or earlier, 40, I guess it was 41, 42, where he met with Churchill and forced Churchill to sign a document that we would develop the rest of the world after the war, and it was called the Atlantic Charter, maybe it was 41. So the people in Sudan were already looking at that as a way to free their country. So America, under Roosevelt, especially, and then under Kennedy, had been looked to as a hero, as heroes, and as America as a country that would lead Africa out of its colonialism. And the funny thing about Sudan, and this is really ironic, I've been to Sudan about 8 times, and the people in Sudan, first of all, they're the nicest people I've met in Africa, but also they like the United States. They're constantly telling me about, oh, the United States is wonderful, we've got to go to the United States. And they would work with the United States in a second if the United States was not so stupid in carrying out British policy. And the United States is still seen in the best possible light in Sudan and other countries in Africa. It's only our own leaders who are doing everything possible to destroy the image of the United States in Africa. And Obama is succeeding. Obama, by the way, this is a nice irony for you, Obama has done zero for Africa. And Africans will tell you that President Bush did more for Africa than President Obama, who allegedly is the son of a Kenyan.
Well, we have just a little more than 6 minutes to go, and I want to get back to the Susan Rice question, because in keeping with what you just said, I found an article in the Ethiopian Review about Susan Rice, and they concluded the article by saying her confirmation will mark the saddest day for human rights throughout the world, and particularly for Africans. So there are some people who see this, but the question that comes up is, if Obama is committed to ramming this through, and if McCain and Lindsey Graham and others fight it narrowly as they have been, on the language about Benghazi, even while they're allying with Susan Rice on Syria. What do we do? What do we have to do to break this situation so that Rice cannot be nominated? And actually, Larry, I'd like to just add to that. The fallback now, they're saying, well, if Rice isn't acceptable, McCain and others are saying they would accept John Kerry. But John Kerry has also been one of the leading figures in the Senate on the Democratic side in supporting this responsibility to protect the so-called humanitarian wars. So clearly we've got some work cut out. So what do people have to do to break us out of this situation?
We have to realize that we have really, except for a small handful of individuals, we have really no leadership coming from our political institutions, the Congress and the Senate. I mean, we've been a very, as people may know, the LaRouche PAC has been very active in the last few weeks, and I've gotten firsthand reports that, again, outside of a small group of thoughtful people, these institutions are not functioning. And the Republicans have no better policy for Africa than the Democrats. Both parties, to be blunt and honest, don't give a damn. And they're going to let millions die in Africa. They may not all be as aggressive as Susan Rice, who seems to hate Africans, but they will not do anything to develop Africa. And they're not doing very much, obviously, to develop the United States. I think what we have to realize is we have to expand the thinking of the American citizen, and the LaRouche PAC has just added a major weapon to the arsenal, which is our new report on the how Andrew Jackson destroyed the National Bank. Because if people understood what the United States was meant to be from 1789, I guess, up to 1832, that we were a unique country in the world. We had a unique conception of mankind and extending our, making our economic policy and national bank credit policy for the development of our country and by extension development of the world. This was destroyed by a British operation run through General Jackson, Andrew Jackson at the time, from in 1828, 32, and 36. And this destroyed the actual most important principle of the United States, which was credit for development. That same concept of credit for development is not only critical for returning the United States to what it once was, but that's the key to developing Africa, that you have to set up a basis of not money, but credit that creates something in the future that's an improvement and an advance of what you have in the present. It's a net increase, but it can only come in the future, and we need leaders in Africa, and we don't have them. To be honest with you, I can be frank with you, we have to have leaders in Africa who live in the future, who say, this is what I want my country to be 20, 40 years from now, and I'm going to adopt policies today to get it there.
Well,
and
I assume it's fair to say that given the raw material potential of the land and also the qualities of the population, that if you had that kind of leadership, investments in Africa of credit would be one of the created the highest returns of productive wealth, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. If we could get a group of African leaders to work with Mr. LaRouche in implementing these development programs, which would require defeating the British monetary control over the continent, which they are everywhere. I mean, in Nigeria, the British imperialist forces, such as Royal Dutch Shell, they exist in every crack of the Nigerian government. They're all over the Congo. They're everywhere. If we could throw these people out, these genocidalists out, and actually implement these development policies, we would see a blossoming of Africa that would astonish everyone within 20 to 40 years. And that's what we got to do. And the American people have to see that the policies for developing Africa are very similar to what we have to do in the United States, but it requires the American citizen to take these issues personally into themselves and take responsibility for breaking and changing their own thinking. I mean, the fact that we have people saying that you can't attack Susan Rice because she's black and because she's a woman, I mean, this is absurd. You have a person carrying out mass murder, and because she has a black skin and she's a woman, we can't attack her? This is not acceptable. This is unconscionable for people to use that argument. We have a responsibility for our own country, but we've always been a beacon and hope for the rest of the world, and we have to become that again. And that means we have to get Rice defeated, but we actually have to get Obama defeated and get a presidency in the United States that really represents what we once were and what we can be.
And Larry, we're going to have to end it there. I encourage our listeners once again, go to the website, the Executive Intelligence Review website, and read Larry's article, Defeat Susan Rice, for her genocide in Africa, and this issue, the December 7th issue. And Larry, thanks for joining us today. Don't forget, this coming Friday, as in every Friday, we're going to have Lyndon LaRouche live on LaRouche PAC, with his Friday project. And we'll be back next Saturday with the LaRouche Show. So thanks for joining us, and do something to change the world.
Yes, you must. Thank you, Harley.
Okay, Larry.